award-winning author and activist. Very happy birthday to Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
On 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/KBOOMradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/KBOO.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/KBOOradio.
We also provide content to the Free Music Archive,
an interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Show your support for KBOO programming by picking up the special limited edition KBOO Music That Moves You silicone collapsible water bottle. It's the perfect accessory to keep you hydrated while KBOO keeps you moving. Get yours now at kboo.fm/movesbottle.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Department of Transportation to spend $412 million on highways. Biden repeals controversial immigration ban, Title 42. And, in international news, Sri Lanka protests gain momentum amid historic economic crisis. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 1st, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. The Oregon Department of Transportation is spending $412 million of federal transportation funds to repair and construct its highways. The funds were provided as part of President Biden's $1 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, a bipartisan infrastructure package that critics say was passed at the expense of much-needed social welfare and environmental legislation. Oregon received $1.2 billion total. Most of that money is set aside by the federal government for electric vehicle charging stations, natural disaster protection, and public transportation. The $412 million being spent on highways is from the discretionary portion of the package. Environmental and transportation activists have been pressing the Department of Transportation to invest more of that money in sustainable transportation projects, such as road safety, bike and pedestrian pathways, and public transit. Activists and lawmakers supporting a green pivot expressed disappointment in the final plan. A new report has revealed that Oregon is the sixth highest state ranking in domestic extremism incidents in the nation over the last decade. These statistics, as reported from the Secretary of State, largely pertain to incidents associated with the 2020's nearly nightly racial rights demonstrations in Portland and during an aggressive pro-Trump demonstration downtown where a person was shot by a counter-protester. The ranking is also influenced by incidents like December 2020's breach of the Oregon State Capitol building by right-wing Reopen Oregon demonstrators. According to the report, Oregon is one of only 16 states that doesn't have any legislation defining or criminalizing domestic terrorism or domestic violent extremism at the state level. Sociologist and extremism expert Randy Blazak said, quote, "We have a long history of extremist groups in the state," end quote, and noted the state has been a hotbed for white supremacist groups and militias. Another significant incident supporting the report occurred in 2016, when a group of far-right extremists took over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Events date back further, including a 1984 incident with the Rhenish group intentionally giving hundreds of people salmonella, attempting to limit voter turnout. Following the release of the report, Secretary of State Shemaiah Fagan in the Oregon Audits Division announced an advisory response that identifies efforts that state agencies can undertake to thwart future incidents of domestic extremism. On Wednesday, Fagan said, quote, "Oregon must be an inclusive place where everyone feels safe, and the rise in domestic terrorism in Oregon is an immediate threat, and we cannot simply wait for the next incident to occur," end quote. Fagan maintained immediate steps can and will be taken to prevent individuals at risk from becoming radicalized and becoming violent. Oregon released its first annual Oregon Early Childhood Inclusion Report yesterday. It outlines our progress in that area, including whether certain indicators are met across the state. According to federal data, about 48% of young children experiencing disabilities in Oregon receive all services in early learning settings. Some feel Oregon's programs still need improvement to be fully inclusive. Oregon Department of Education Early Childhood Coherent Strategy Specialist Meredith Villines said, quote, "Since the Individuals with Disabilities Act was developed 30 plus years ago, children experiencing disabilities have limited access or are often asked to leave care even in preschool. So we're hoping to change that," end quote. The report says Oregon is showing improvements statewide in some indicators, including policies, funding, and sharing new guidance. Three Oregon counties also showed progress in meeting community indicators, including building awareness and providing access to training. Going forward, the three counties plan to sustain funding and scale inclusive practices. The counties have already set goals to bring more children experiencing disabilities into programs, to 30% in Lincoln County, 60% in Multnomah County, and 65% in Clackamas County by 2023. Did you know April is National Volunteer Month? No fooling. Portlanders are spending April giving back to their community and volunteering their time to make a change. With more on this local story, it's Eric Tegetoff.
April is National Volunteer Month, recognizing the time people give to help their local communities. John Afril is with Hands On Greater Portland, the largest volunteer center in Oregon, and a program of the United Way of the Columbia Willamette. He says the past 2 years of the pandemic have been challenging for nonprofits that rely on volunteers. However, Afril says interest in volunteering never fully waned.
One of the things that's been so rewarding the past couple of years is seeing the influx of people really wanting to give back and support their community.
Afril says social distancing rules and other regulations due to COVID-19 often meant organizations had to limit the number of opportunities available. His group pairs people with volunteer opportunities in the area that interest them. He says in pre-pandemic times, about 20,000 people used its site every year. Afril says volunteering is an easy first step to becoming engaged in community issues.
As a result of that experience, they can feel so much more empowered. They can understand, here's something that I can do that's tangible, that's really making a difference in my community. That makes them feel so much more fulfilled about their role in society.
Afril notes there are ways even for people with busy schedules to get involved, including some duties that are just 2 or 3 hours in length and don't require training or an ongoing commitment.
You can just go and take immediate action. You can fit volunteerism into your schedule, no matter if you are working days or nights or weekends.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
The United States House of Representatives has passed a bill capping the monthly cost of insulin at $35 for insured patients. This is part of an election year effort to curb prices on prescription drugs during a time of rising inflation. The Affordable Insulin Now Act, which passed yesterday, provides significant relief for privately insured patients with less benefit for patients enrolled in Medicare. The bill does not help the uninsured. All insured patients should get the benefit of predictable monthly costs for insulin. Public opinion polls have consistently shown support across party lines for congressional action to limit drug costs. The insulin bill represents just one provision of a broader prescription drug package being pushed by President Biden. The Biden bill would authorize Medicare to negotiate prices for a range of drugs, including insulin. It would penalize pharma companies raising prices faster than inflation, as well as overhaul the Medicare prescription drug benefit to limit out-of-pocket costs for enrollees. Biden's agenda passed the House, but not the Senate. Democrats still hope to get the legislation moving again, preserving its drug pricing curbs. For the insulin legislation to fully pass Congress, 10 Republican senators need to vote in favor of it. Democrats are worried that's not going to happen. Critics say the bill would raise premiums and fails to target pharmaceutical middlemen who contribute to high list prices for insulin. The idea of a $35 monthly cost cap for insulin actually had bipartisan development. The Trump administration created a voluntary option for Medicare enrollees to get insulin for that amount, and the Biden administration continued it. Experts do complain the House bill would not help uninsured people who face the highest out-of-pocket costs for insulin. Also, the House legislation would not help patients with diabetes who take other medications as well as insulin. About 37 million Americans have diabetes, and an estimated 6 to 7 million use insulin to control their blood sugars. Patients who can't afford their insulin may reduce or skip doses, which can lead to serious medical complications and even death. Economist Sherry Gleed of New York University said, quote, "This will make private insurance for people with diabetes a much more attractive proposition," end quote. Dan Kildee, Democrat Michigan, and a co-sponsor of the House bill said, quote, "If 10 Republicans stand between the American people being able to get access to affordable insulin, that's a good question for 10 Republicans to answer. Republicans get diabetes too. Republicans die from diabetes," end quote. The White House is lifting a pandemic-era executive order signed by former President Trump, which blocked migrants from entering the country. The order will officially be nullified in May. Title 14 banned all families and single migrants attempting to cross the Mexican border under the pretense of limiting the spread of COVID-19. Immigration and public health experts said the measure lacked credibility and instead reinforced the racist association between immigration and disease. The end of Title 42 takes the U.S. back to its pre-existing immigration policy, which allowed the Department of Homeland Security to detain or remove immigrant families without asylum claims. Asylum claims are notoriously difficult to obtain for migrants fleeing violence in Central America. The White House expects the number of people seeking asylum at the border to increase as a result. The timing of Biden's announcement coincides with the White House decision to accept up to 100,000 refugees from the war in Ukraine. While migration advocates have applauded the responsiveness of the United States and European countries to the Ukrainian refugee crisis, they point out a stark double standard when it comes to non-white refugees. People fleeing similar levels of violence in Central America, the Middle East, and Africa have faced detention, deportation, and apathy. In response to rising energy prices from the crisis in Europe, President Joe Biden is releasing unprecedented quantities from America's national oil reserves. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
This is a wartime bridge to increase oil supply until production ramps up later this year. And it is by far the largest release of our national reserve in our history.
To address pain at the gas pump, President Joe Biden says the U.S. will be draining roughly 1 million barrels a day for the next 6 months from the country's strategic petroleum reserve. Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said the release is just a Band-Aid.
The reserve is supposed to exist for giant unforeseen crises, such as a war between great powers. It's not there so that anti-energy politicians whose policies have raised gas prices can try to hide that from the public.
The president also called on U.S. oil producers to ramp up production, but many are hesitant that new drilling won't pay off in the long term, given the White House's push for cleaner energy. Russian troops withdrew from parts of northern and central Ukraine, but now are gathering in the southeast. The Pentagon says an initial half dozen shipments of weapons and other security assistance have reached the country. Amid reports that the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas supported efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling for a code of ethics for the high court. She sidestepped questions about whether Justice Thomas should step down.
If your wife is an admitted and proud contributor to a coup of our country, maybe you should weigh that in your ethical standards.
Legislation to cap the cost of insulin at $35 a month passed the House. Critics say it doesn't go far enough and shifts more costs onto insurers and employers. And today, the House is expected to pass a bill to federally legalize marijuana, but it may not have enough support to bypass a Senate filibuster. A House panel is considering legislation to strengthen banking overdraft protections, which consumer advocate Jeremy Greer called an abusive form of high-cost credit.
The majority of overdraft fees were incurred on transactions of $24 or less and were repaid within 3 days, meaning that a $34 overdraft fee would have an annual percentage rate of 17,000%.
Banks and credit unions rake in roughly $12 billion a year in overdraft fees. Senators are closing in on a $10 billion COVID funding deal that leaves out $5 billion in foreign assistance. The White House had requested $22 billion. Democrats are calling on Biden to extend the moratorium on federal student loan payments through the end of the year. The suspension is set to expire May 1st. And the Biden administration marked Thursday's Transgender Day of Visibility.
The State Department and Department of Homeland Security announced new steps that will improve the travel experience for transgender Americans.
White House spokeswoman Kate Bedingfield says those changes include allowing the option for U.S. citizens to select X when identifying gender on a passport. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is rainy, with temperatures in the high 40s. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy, with temperatures in the 50s. Today is not April Fool's Day. April Fool's Day is a civil holiday at only one place in the world, Odessa, Ukraine. In normal years, Odessa residents would celebrate with parades and street fairs. The quote of the day is a folk saying from Odessa. On April 1st, I trust nobody. In a blow to gun safety, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb signed a bill into law allowing people to purchase and carry handguns without obtaining a permit. Gun safety activists and law enforcement alike have warned that the bill would increase rates of gun violence and death by suicide. Jonah Chester has more.
Indiana's new law allowing people to carry a handgun without a permit is raising concerns from the state's gun safety advocates. Under the law signed by Governor Eric Holcomb last month, it'll still be illegal for folks who are barred from carrying a handgun before the measure passed to do so come July, when the law takes effect. But Gerald King, with the Indianapolis-based group Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence, says without the permitting process, that's a safeguard without any enforcement mechanism.
It seems to us that large numbers of people who would not have passed background checks will now go to gun shops and buy guns.
Several law enforcement agencies have also raised concerns the measure would streamline the process to acquire a gun, potentially flooding the state with deadly weapons. With the passage of Indiana's law, nearly half of all U.S. states now allow permitless carry in some form. King points out that a previous version of the bill contained compromises to make it more agreeable to critics. But he says the compromise version approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee was referred to the Senate Rules Committee, where it stagnated and died. The Indy Star reports the bill's original language was then inserted into a separate bill on the final day of the legislative session and passed.
Not only was it horrible policy, but it came about through connivance and disingenuous arguments. So it was a pretty bad experience all around.
Jen Hahn with the Indiana chapter of Moms Demand Action says the new measure will have serious consequences for Indiana's kids and teens. According to a January report from the gun control advocacy group Every Town for Gun Safety, an average of 110 Hoosier children and teens die each year from gun violence, and one-third of those deaths are suicides.
We are in a gun violence crisis here in the state of Indiana. The leading cause of death for children and teens in Indiana is gun violence, and a majority of those are gun homicides.
The report says overall gun deaths in Indiana hit a 10-year high in 2020. The gun death rate during that period also increased by nearly 80% in Indiana, compared to 33% nationally. Hahn says Moms Demand Action offers online gun safety resources through its Be Smart for Kids initiative. She adds, for Indianapolis residents, the Marion County Sheriff's Office offers free gun locks. For the Indiana News Service, I'm Jonah Chester.
President Biden commemorated the March 31st Transgender Day of Visibility, issuing a formal statement Wednesday. He honored transgender people, quote, fighting for freedom, equality, dignity, and respect, end quote, and advocated against anti-transgender legislative attacks that have passed in various states across the USA. Transgender Day of Visibility occurs every year on March 31st. It is dedicated to celebrating transgender people and their contributions to society and to raising awareness of the discrimination they face. It was founded in 2009 and has since been led by the U.S.-based youth advocacy organization Trans Student Educational Resources. Biden plans new measures aimed at making the federal government more inclusive for transgender people, including a new X gender option on U.S. passport applications and setting up Transportation Security Administration scanners that are gender neutral. The administration wants to expand the availability of the X gender marker to airlines, federal travel programs, and the White House worker and visitor entry system. It also plans to make it easier for transgender people to change gender information in Social Security Administration records. Additional celebratory plans included hosting Amy Schneider, the first openly transgender Jeopardy champion, at the White House. Schneider met with Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff and Rachel Levine, the Assistant Health Secretary and the first openly transgender federal official to be confirmed by the Senate, for a conversation with transgender kids and their parents. Florida has recently banned instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity in kindergarten through the third grade. Republicans argued these are subjects parents should discuss with their children, while Democrats and others feel the law marginalizes LGBTQI plus people. Biden said, quote, transgender Americans continue to face discrimination, harassment, and barriers to opportunity. In the past year, hundreds of anti-transgender bills in states were proposed across America, most of them targeting transgender kids. The onslaught has continued this year. These bills are wrong. End quote. The White House also announced Health and Human Services will be the first agency to fly a trans pride flag. Pope Francis made history today by apologizing to First Nations peoples of Canada for cultural genocide and abuse in church-run residential schools. His statements come months after mass graves were discovered at the site of several Canadian boarding schools. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Pope Francis has apologized to Canada's Indigenous people for the Catholic Church's role in the Indian residential school system and has asked for forgiveness. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the apology comes after meetings this week at the Vatican between the Pope and First Nations, Métis, and Inuit delegates.
This apology is what many of Canada's Indigenous people have spent lifetimes waiting for and hoping for. The Assembly of First Nations lead delegate Chief Gerald Antoine called it a historic day.
Today is a day that we've been waiting for, and certainly one that will be uplifted in our history. His Holiness Pope Francis, head of the Catholic Church, has issued a long overdue apology for the Roman Catholic role in church-run residential school. It's a historical first step, however, only a first step. The next step is for the Holy Father to apologize to our family at their home.
During the final meetings with delegates from First Nations, Inuit, and Métis, Speaking in Italian, the Pope asked for God's forgiveness for what he called the deplorable conduct of members of the Catholic Church for the wrongs done in residential schools. I want to say, he continued, with all my heart, I am very sorry. About 190 people, including delegates and survivors of the residential schools, had gathered during that final address. The Pope has also promised to travel to Canada in the days around the Feast of St. Anna. That falls on July 26th, but no firm date for the visit has been set. From the late 1800s to the late 1900s, about 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend the government-funded, church-run residential schools across Canada. Thousands were abused. More than 4,000 died. The last residential school closed in 1996. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The FBI and Blackfeet law enforcement executed a search warrant at the residence of the Blackfeet Nation's chairman early Thursday. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports at least four arrests were made for the alleged sale of synthetic opioids.
FBI spokesperson Sandra Barker said a search warrant was executed at Tribal Business Council Chairman Timothy Davis's home, where eight individuals were arrested. Barker said Davis was not among those taken into custody. She said the search is part of an ongoing investigation and declined to share more details about the case. Reached on his cell phone, Chairman Davis told MTPR he was not at home when law enforcement officers searched his residence. He said he did not know anything about the case and declined to comment further. Tribal Councilmember Mark Pollock confirmed that Davis was traveling on behalf of the tribe at the time the warrant was executed. Blackfeet prosecutor Josh Lamson says at least four tribal arrest warrants were served for the alleged sale of a small amount of fentanyl. Those individuals are likely to be arraigned Friday. Lamson says it isn't yet clear what the remaining four people are charged with. The names of those arrested have not been released. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. signed legislation Thursday investing $120 million for affordable housing, low-income home repairs, and other housing needs for Cherokee citizens in Oklahoma. The tribe previously invested $30 million to replace and repair homes of elders, those with disabilities, and energy conservation projects. The new investment comes from the tribe's general revenue fund and dollars from the federal American Rescue Plan. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Russia's attempt to force European countries to pay for gas in rubles rather than dollars and euros appears to have fallen flat, at least for now. In an attempt to stabilize his country's failing currency, President Vladimir Putin told European leaders that Russia would no longer accept payments in anything beside rubles. Europe responded by ignoring the demand, and so far, little appears to have changed. Natural gas exports to Europe form a critical backbone of the Kremlin's financial backing, and Russian fossil fuels have enabled the costly invasion of Ukraine. European countries, especially Germany, the world's fourth largest economy, remain dependent on Russian fossil fuels to sustain their energy grid. Although the United States has stepped up energy exports to Europe, experts say it isn't nearly enough to offset the consequences of Russia turning off the gas. At least for now, the two blocs are locked in mutual dependence on the environmentally destructive fuel. In spite of the invasion, pipelines from Russia through Ukraine continue to flow. Pipeline fees also constitute a significant portion of Ukraine's state budget, meaning natural gas quite literally fuels every side of the conflict. Massive protests have broken out in Sri Lanka against its Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa and his family, which holds sway over national politics in the South Asian island nation. Rajapaksa rose to power during the country's civil war. It ended the conflict in part by herding civilians into no-fire zones and bombing them, a massacre that killed around 40,000 ethnic Tamils. Since the end of the civil war, the ruling family has detained and disappeared critics under the guise of anti-terrorism. Rajapaksa has been popular among the country's Buddhist majority, but protests signify that that support may be waning. Sri Lanka is experiencing its worst economic crisis since independence. Its government borrowed billions of dollars from China for infrastructure projects, most of which was embezzled by the Rajapaksa family. In a response to ballooning foreign debt, the family-run government instituted an import ban in 2020, which has caused severe shortages in essential goods. Yesterday appeared to be a tipping point in public sentiment. The government announced 13-hour daily power cuts Thursday to mitigate the ongoing financial crisis. Hospitals were forced to cancel essential surgeries. Protests so far have remained mostly peaceful, but the sense of urgency is growing. Hundreds of protesters attempted to storm the estate of Mahinda's brother, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who currently serves as the country's president. Dozens of protesters have been arrested. You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, April 1st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegetoff. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned.